and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty.
And I'm Brian Hefty. Thanks for joining us today. Well, today on the show, we're going to talk a little about the nutrient iron. And no, when we say iron, we're not talking about equipment or anything like that today, at least. We are going to talk a little about fertility because we get so many questions about this all the time. And I don't think we spend enough time on iron. We talk an awful lot about N, P, and K, quite a bit about sulfur, zinc, boron, but not a lot of time on iron. So we wanted to focus on that on our show today. As always, if you've got any questions for us, you can email them in radio@agphd.com, or you can give us a call here, 844-44-AG-PHD. That's 844-442-4743. So we will discuss iron throughout the show, but right now, let's get to the AG-PHD mailbag.
Got this one from John, and he said, does it make any sense to deep band phosphorus and potash, but not strip till? So I'm taking that as just randomly place it out in the field deep.
Yes.
Throughout.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that's going to be superior to strip till. The strip till makes the most sense because you're placing the fertilizer right where you know the crop roots are going to be. So that will give you the best efficiency. But the reason why you would consider doing something like he's suggesting, just as a general statement, and getting it down below the soil surface, is if you've got nutrient stratification. And I hate to say it, but almost all farmers have nutrient stratification with these immobile nutrients. The immobile nutrients we would classify as phosphorus, potassium, copper, zinc, just to name a few. Okay, so those are four fairly popular nutrients, especially the P and the K. Now, I'm not saying in all cases potassium won't move in soil, because if you've got light soil, lots of rain, lots of heat, it is going to move down. It's just going to be really slow. But I mean, phosphorus, copper, zinc, they're pretty immobile in soil. I mean, even in light soil. So if you've got most of those nutrients in the top inch or two, and you soil test down deeper and you go, you know, in the 3 to 8 inch range, I have nothing, yet that's where 90% of my roots are, it makes an awful lot of sense to get those nutrients down where you're going to find more moisture and more roots. You get better uptake, and you'll have that crop being a lot more drought tolerant, because you've got, I mean, when things do turn dry, even if it's a week, maybe it's a month. It's very common for us to not have rain for a month where we farm. And so the top couple, 3, 4, 5, 6 inches, they're going to dry out. But boy, if you've got roots deep, you got nutrients deep, you got water deep, you're still good. So yeah, I think it's a great idea. But again, I would prefer strip till, just because now I know for sure I have better first year recovery.
All right, thanks for the question. Next one comes from Matt in Michigan. Got two different fields there, Brian. Okay, so he's got a 14 or 15 acre field that he did in 1 acre grids. He's got a 75 acre field that he did in 2 acre grids, so, or 2.5 acre grids. So a couple different grid sizes here to take a look at. He said, I would greatly appreciate if you look at my soil tests and see if you've got any opinion on what could be limiting my yield. I'm having a hard time getting an average above 150 for corn.
Well, first of all, I would say your potassium is really low.
Phosphorus is really high. Phosphorus is good.
Was phosphorus that high?
Average on the 73 acre field.
Yeah, 210 pounds of phosphorus. Okay, now assuming that's actual phosphorus and not phosphate, I agree with Darren, but I don't know because I don't know. It says P, but unfortunately, some people will say P, and what they really mean is P205. So as long as it's actual P and pounds, then I'm good. Yeah, you got 200 pounds, that'd be about 105 parts per million. That sounds great to me. But yeah, your biggest limiting factor here that I see just right off the top is the potassium thing. Now, I will also say you've got spots where pH is hurting you a little bit too. There's a spot of 5.4, for example, on one. Let's see, and that was the smaller field. I was just about to look at the bigger field. Same thing there. You've got some spots where you're down to 5.5 or something. So we got to address those. I'll also say where you have high pH, try to manage those a little bit differently. and take a look at, okay, what's really causing my problem here? Can I do something to get that fixed? And, you know, when I take just my first glance at it on your high pH spots, I can't really tell. I mean, there's nothing that's way out of whack. I mean, you're only at 75-80% calcium, so it's not that bad. And magnesium, a lot of that's 12-15, not bad. So what's causing that problem? I don't know. Usually we'll say it's drainage. We could have a sodium issue there, something like that. I mean, but your sodium levels aren't off the charts. So more than anything, I just tell you it's probably some kind of nutrient imbalance. And when I look at your soil tests, for as many pounds of phosphorus as you have out there, you don't have enough zinc. Usually we're talking 10
spots,
to 1.
Though, some spots we get a tremendous amount of zinc. It's really variable.
I'm glad you used the word variable, Darren, because that's what we talk about every day here.
On that smaller field, there are some spots with zinc as high as 33. There are some spots in the bigger field with zinc as high as 20.
Yeah, I know, but that's still low. So, and it's 20 because he's got so much phosphorus there. So Darren mentioned earlier high phosphorus. Okay, just as an example, he's got one where he has 283 pounds of phosphorus. So if you've got 283 on phosphorus, we'd like to see roughly 28 pounds of zinc.
We've also got copper as high as 7 in some of these spots. And that's going to be an interesting thing. So
yeah,
here's,
but you need that, Darren. I mean, when your phosphorus is up there, 30 to 1 is roughly the ratio with phosphorus to copper, and 10 to 1 phosphorus to zinc. Go ahead.
It's interesting. Now, I guess I'm guessing that's from beef cattle manure, judging by the name on the soil test here. But when you think about this is where we like to do 1-acre grids when we've got this much variability, and then we match them up to our yield monitor. And we see, okay, where are high-yielding spots? What are our nutrient levels there? Where are low-yielding spots? What are our nutrient levels there? And look for correlations.
Yeah, I'd go much further than that. You got to look at every spot and take what the yield is, and then you can really see what's going on. But it just looks to me like, for him, a lot of these base saturation Ks are 1%, maybe 2%. That's the number one thing. Fix your zinc, a little more boron, just a few minor things. You should be in good shape. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Pentair Hypro Ultra Low Drift Nozzles are your ideal choice for the Enlist E3 herbicide system. With coverage comparable to flat fans and with 90% less drift, ULD nozzles meet all required standards for Enlist applications and provide optimal performance of contact herbicides. Learn more at pentair.com/hypro.
Your soybeans are in the bin, but the game isn't over yet. Score more points this year by taking your beans to the end zone. At $10 beans, every point of moisture below your target takes away 15 cents per bushel. Reclaim that lost yield with the End Zone Bin System from Farm Shop MFG.
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at soilwarrior.com.
Acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, nobody scrutinizes performance like you do. And acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, the consistent performance of Vasgro brand soybeans helps to keep your profitability out in front, offering leading agronomic expertise and 100% exclusive genetics for strong yield potential. Ask your dealer how much further you can grow when Vasgro leads the way. Always read and follow grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
No matter what time of the year it is on your farm, with a Bayer Plus Rewards program, earning and redeeming rewards are always in season. Because when you buy two or more eligible seed or crop protection products throughout the year, you earn $3 per acre in cashback rewards. Cash you can redeem and reinvest in your farm later in the season. That's Bayer Plus Rewards, and that's how we're helping make every part of your season, well, rewarding. Visit MyBayerPlus.com to learn more. See program terms and conditions for full details.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Now, if you heard that our topic is iron, you may have thought, oh, awesome, we're going to talk equipment on today's show. Yeah, that would be fun. That'd be a lot of fun. I think it's going to be really fun talking about the crop nutrient iron. And I'm going to bet that you've noticed differences in your fields, even if you haven't soil tested. I was just talking to a grower this year, and he said, man, I don't know what it is. I've got the same soybean variety across my whole field, but on this part of the field, it is dark, dark green. And on the other part of the field, it's kind of a lighter shade of green. What could be going on? And I just asked the question. I said, well, what about your iron levels? Well, I have no idea. Haven't measured those. I've mainly been focused on N, P, and K. Well, this is something you might want to take a look at. I know that when we talk to golf course superintendents, they sure know about iron because they like to put a little extra iron on to try to make things dark green and really attractive. Now, will that amount to more yield for you? I don't know that, but I do know that you can see some differences just in the plants and how they look. We're real happy to have Patrick Chase with us right now, a state soil scientist in the state of Iowa. Patrick, do you ever notice those differences out in fields where you see a different color in the crop?
Oh, most definitely. And everybody tries to wonder what it might be, but yeah, iron is one of those extra things that's kind of unseen and unknown about unless you really dig into it.
All right, so talk to us about it a little bit. Are there some things that you're looking at? I mean, obviously you get to see a lot of different information from across the state, but do you notice iron problems in high pH, low pH, certain soil types, those types of things?
Yeah, typically it's your higher pH systems that have that deficiency just because your nutrients are just that lack of availability. It's either in higher pH soils or soils that are just have too much nutrient that's applied and it's tying up the system with the biology.
Great point. Brian was talking about balance of nutrients, and we actually had a couple of soil tests that were extremely high in a couple of nutrients, and just judging by the name on the sample, the word beef was in there, so I'm assuming they were getting a lot of manure. Is this kind of what you're talking about here with over application potentially?
Yes, you typically the ones we notice are nitrogen and phosphorus of over application of, and that just ties it up. It doesn't make it as available,
you know,
so go ahead.
No, finish your point. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, so trying to get those soaked up in some way, shape, or form, especially in some cases where we've been encountering drought around, so we have a lot of nutrient out there that hasn't been utilized by our crop, and is that going to negatively impact next crop is something to be aware of.
That was part of where I was going here. We've had some wildly different weather years the last few years. And what was interesting, I've talked to a number of farmers who have said, man, my best yielding spots from 2018 and 2019 were my worst yielding spots in 2020 and vice versa. How come the bad yielding spots were my best? And I said, well, by any chance, were they the low ground areas of your field? Well, yes, they were. Well, no wonder. You know, we had drastically different moisture conditions, but you think about it. If you did a broadcast rate of whether it's commercial fertilizer or manure, you put extra nutrients out in a spot that didn't yield for 2 years. Now all of a sudden you had the year set up just right. There's probably tons of fertility there just ready to go.
Mm-hmm. And that's where if you're having encounters like that, cover crop usage is huge in trying to at least utilize what you put out there to make a slow-release fertilizer in the future if there's that opportunity available.
All right, I'm glad you brought the cover crop thing up too, because I've had some growers from different parts of the country say, what are the guys in Iowa talking about? Isn't that all flat, black, heavy, deep soil? I don't think that's exactly the case, is it, across the whole state?
Only about, I don't know, a quarter to less than that north-central Iowa is the flat, black. Everything else has a pretty steady slope to it, especially the southern part. And some really fragile soils we got to protect. So we have really great soils that were given to us here in Iowa because of the deep rooting systems of the prairie, but our cropping systems don't exactly replicate that. So trying to keep that biology fed as much as possible throughout the year is the ultimate goal on trying to raise those organic matters back to those historic levels. And that organic matter alone can help buffer some of these issues with your iron and other nutrients, either too much or too little of.
You know, okay, let's talk about that for just a second. What do you see and what kind of ranges do you see for organic matter across the state? And if you were to give some recommendations and say, you know, here's an organic matter level that you should probably be shooting for.
Mm-hmm. I mean, around the state, they try to aim for 5%. North Central Iowa probably had 10, 12, 15% in some areas. And now we're down to that 5 to 7 because they've farmed it, tilled it, drained it, and it just has depleted it from some of the practices that are there. Anywhere else in the state, we're aiming for that 5. Some of them are 1, 2, 3% if they've really been either farmed hard, had a lot of erosion, things of that nature. So trying to revitalize those soils from past history.
Yeah, I think it's good to have some targets that we're shooting for. Today we're talking about iron, and we've been real fortunate to have Patrick Chase with us here, a state soil scientist in the state of Iowa. Patrick, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on here, and good luck here heading to the end of the year. Boy, we're almost the end of the year.
It's coming.
It's coming quick. Hey, thanks, Patrick. Really appreciate it. Jump up to Minnesota, get Steve Carlson with us right now. I want to talk a little about some of these iron situations in high pH soils. I know there's a product that Steve gets a chance to work with a lot, Soy Green. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, good afternoon, Brian. Good afternoon, Darren. How are we doing?
Good, good. Okay, so we've got iron issues in high pH soils. Can you explain it real quick for us and then talk to us about how to fix it?
Yeah, absolutely. pH is often a great indicator for some of that lack of availability of the iron that we see. And essentially, it's just a function of the binding in the soil. You know, I heard you guys talking about soil tests a little bit earlier, and oftentimes you can get those tests coming back where there's technically a lot of iron in that soil, but is it in a plant-available form? And that's really where we run into the issues of, hey, we may have iron in the system, but it's just not getting there. And that's really where we encounter those IDC conditions of those ugly yellow stunted beans that can be noticed throughout the upper Midwest at times during the season. And really correcting that is a huge issue that we try and make sure that we do with a number of different things. And one of them being the application of a product like Soy Green to really make sure that the iron that we're putting in that furrow is really available to that crop.
Okay, you mentioned in furrow, and I think that's really key. We see the best results when we get that iron out there in the furrow available for that soybean plant. Because let's face it, soybeans don't have these huge root systems to go out and find everything out there in a broadcast application. So talk to us about that. How much do you need to put on if you're in a severe situation? Because there are definitely some pockets out there where iron deficiency, chlorosis, and yellowing of soybeans is severe.
Yeah, it could be tremendously severe, and you're 100% right. Keeping it in that furrow and in that root zone is critical. Again, having it where the plant can reach it is epically important. The nice thing that we've done over the years, and believe it or not, Soy Green's 20th birthday is actually this year. It's been 20 years in the market with this product. But what we've done over those 20 years is done a couple different things where we have our traditional Soy Green product where you mix it up. The most common use rate that we see for that one is 3 pounds per acre. And that's just blended with water at a site or a mixing site. And great results. Long time in the portfolio. But we've made several other great additions, too, with products like our Soy Green AST product, which is a liquid formulation that's advanced stabilization technology. And what we've been able to incorporate there is some other components to help have better residual in that soil activity and keeping that furrow longer. That one's been a great one. We've seen that yeast rate really be successful at 1 gallon per acre. And then the other thing that's been really revolutionary for the Soy Green family is our granular form of this. It's a granular prill that can be utilized in those air seeders, which oftentimes many of those air seeder markets with the soybeans has some of the worst IDC that we see throughout the region. And the ability to get a granular prill in that furrow at about 6 to 9 pounds per acre has been epically valuable in correcting some of those really bad IDC conditions. It's kind of funny you say, because we were actually, I was going over our data for 2020 from our third-party replicated plots with the University of Minnesota and NDSU, and man, IDC was really tough. In those sites, I think we averaged for IDC acres, it was about a bushel, 20 bushels is what we were seeing in the checks. Wow. And where we utilize Soy Green at that appropriate rate, I think we averaged 49.5 bushels, so I mean, almost a 30-bushel swing.
Not something you'd expect every year, but certainly in those hot spots this year, it was a big deal. Hey, thanks, Steve. We'll be right back.
Revitec fungicide from BASF has been specifically developed for the selective soybean grower who doesn't compromise. If you think good is good enough, if you're okay with just achieving rather than overachieving, if average is your goal, this is not the fungicide for you. Revitec fungicide, brand new chemistry, 3 no-excuse modes of action, 0 modes of compromise. Sounds like the fungicide for you. Revitec fungicide from BASF, that's smart. Always read and follow label directions.
A lot goes into keeping a precision operation moving. The inputs you choose have to deliver results. New Dallaro Complete Fungicide from Bayer offers unmatched consistency and the most complete disease control available. Your corn and soybeans are protected and yields higher even in unpredictable conditions. With Dallaro Complete, you get results you can count on to help keep your precision operation running smoothly. Always read and follow label instructions. To learn more, visit DallaroComplete.us today.
Give your corn a strong defense against stress throughout the season with MycoApply Endoprime SC. MycoApply Endoprime SC uses four specially selected species of mycorrhizal fungi to protect your crop against stress. That means more access to water and key micronutrients while building a healthy soil structure for stronger crops for years to come. Stronger corn starts beneath the surface. Learn more about MycoApply Endoprime SC at EndoprimeCorn.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
It's about time. Applied at Planting, new Xyway 3D fungicide from FMC delivers foliar disease protection from planting to harvest. Active ingredient flutriafol moves from the soil through the corn as it grows for inside-out protection from roots to tassel. For season-long protection, choose first-of-its-kind Enfuro Xyway 3D fungicide. To learn more, call 815-362-7747 today. Always read and follow all label directions.
We now bring you an important news bulletin.
This just in from Live Action News.
Innovation has come to the world of burndown.
New Elevore herbicide controls your toughest weeds, even glyphosate and ALS-resistant weeds like mare's tail and henbit. Talk with your retailer about Elevore herbicide today and ask how you can start elevating your burndown.
Each year brings new and unique challenges to farming, and your operation needs to constantly adapt to meet them. That's why at AgBiome, we're working every day to bring you new and better solutions. Microbial-based solutions that protect your crop and help it reach its full potential. To learn more about how we're doing it, visit agbiome.com. That's AGBIOME.com. AgBiome, feeding the world responsibly. Partnering with microbes for human benefit.
Talking about iron on today's Ag PhD radio program. Taking your calls and agronomic questions too at 844-44-AG-PHD. We got Mark on with us right now up in Wisconsin. Mark, how are you doing today?
Good. Is this Brian or Darren?
You got both of us.
Yep, we're both here.
Oh, okay. Well, here's the deal. I'm a full-time farmer. That's when busy in the spring and fall, but I love drain tile and all of that, and I'd like to buy a tile plow for myself and then to help pay for it and possibly even as a supplemental income, maybe drain tile some custom.
Yep.
Do you know of any type of crop that a person could raise so you don't have to drain tile when it's 30 below?
Sure. Okay, so Mark, we have had our own tile plow on our farm for 13 years now. And yep. Most of the time we have done our tiling in crop, unless we have pattern tile stuff we need to do. Then what we have done is we have raised winter wheat, put it in the fall, harvested it in, let's call it middle of July. Now, you can do spring wheat as well, and for us, you'd harvest that usually around the 1st of August. So it, not a whole lot different, but either way, yeah, we've just raised wheat. And I like wheat, number one, as a base when you're out there because that really helps make things dry. But, I mean, it is great when you're out tiling in August or September, so that's really good. Another option, though, is you certainly could cut silage. If you raised a hybrid maybe that's 5-10 days earlier than normal, so not much different, and you cut silage. I mean, this year we were cutting silage the end of August, so we still had plenty of time before we started regular harvest to throw in some tile, and that's exactly what we did, by the way. otherwise, it ends up, some falls, it works out great. Like this fall, we've had all kinds of time. I mean, we harvested early. Everything was way ahead. But in 2018 and 2019, there was almost no time in the fall because it was a cold. Those were cold years and wet in the fall. And, oh, it was a pain. But, no, I totally understand. Yep. You don't want to be out there trying to tile when it is super cold. You can tile until, I mean, with just a regular farmer tile plow, until the frost is roughly a foot deep. We'll do some of that. Like even in the very wettest areas, we've got one spot that I have told our guys, hey, we got to wait till we got maybe 6 inches of frost, maybe even a foot of frost, because we couldn't get out there. Even though this is the driest year we've had since 2012, we still couldn't get in just one little spot. And I'm like, just let it freeze up a little bit. We'll pull through and that's fine. But yeah, for the majority of it, if you can, it's great when you're there in the summertime. It's really nice. And I will say too, if all you're going to do is put in just a little bit of spot tiling, because we've got somewhat hilly ground, and so in some of our fields we can get by with just a few tile lines in the whole field, that's it. We just go do that right in crop. And my general rule for that is, as long as the crop is less than a foot tall, we're creating almost no yield loss out there. I mean, it's almost unbelievable, but we've done this in corn, in beans, works great. So that's what we do most of the time. But like I say, if we want to pattern tile and really rip up the field and we're putting in tile every 25 feet or whatever, then yeah, we're putting in wheat. Now, there are other short season crops. Some guys raise peas. I mean, there are just a number of short season crops out there. So it all depends on what you want to do. But yeah, we have just typically gone wheat.
Okay. Wheat tends to, I mean, Wisconsin used to be a big wheat state, but ironically enough, we don't get very good test weight around here, so
the test weight
doesn't work very well.
Sure, the test weight, by the way, that's usually nitrogen. That's a shortage of nitrogen mid to late season. So if you just make sure you have plenty of nitrogen out there mid season, you're generally going to have pretty darn good test weight. So that's not the big issue for me. The big issue for me is just, it just doesn't dollar up as well as corn or soybeans. So I'd love to raise some wheat. It'd be great to have a three-crop rotation, but we take a $300 an acre hit, and, I mean, that's kind of tough to afford.
That's a lot.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So, anyway.
Okay.
Hopefully that
helps.
Thank you, Brian. You bet.
I have to run.
Yep, thank you.
Yep. Bye.
All right, a little more on our iron discussion. We've got Nathan Jones with us, a state soil scientist for the state of South Dakota. Nathan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, you bet. Happy to be here.
You know, we were talking about iron a little bit, and I would say probably the most calls we get about iron are the high pH situations where we're seeing some yellowing soybeans out there. Do you see some other big issues with iron with all the different crops you get to look at across the state of South Dakota?
You know, honestly, in South Dakota, we don't hear a lot about that. When there is a problem with iron, like you said, it's going to be high pH. Luckily, our corn and beans are mostly on the east side, so our high pH soils are not there. So the other problem would be your wet soils, you know, the potholes in the wetter areas. Last couple of years, like you just said, they've been wet. But for the most part, we don't get a lot of calls with iron concerns. Part of that is because our soils are inherently iron rich. But, you know, when you do get high pH and wet soils, that's just a bad combination.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, you're right. We've been wet for a couple of years, too. We know that only lasts for so long in South Dakota, though, right? Eventually, it is going to get dry again.
Yep, and things always swing. You know, it's kind of like a vicious cycle. You just got to wait for it to come back.
Okay, talk to us a little bit. You mentioned that our soils in South Dakota, in general, we've got a pretty decent amount of iron. We do get a lot of questions from our listeners from all over, just wondering what's South Dakota like and why are farmers in certain parts of South Dakota raising such high yields? What do you see as being driving factors?
Well, for the eastern part of the state, I think the high yields are blessed by the fact that there's a lot more rain there. You get into western South Dakota, just the west side of the Missouri River, our rain amounts decrease a lot. So we do end up with some pretty good production on the west side. They've got good rains. Those guys that are implementing good, you know, farming practices obviously do better. The guys that do well out on the west side, where there is less rain, they implement, you know, a lot of the five soil health principles, just because that helps. You know, keep a lot of that rain that falls out of the sky in the soil, prevents it from running off and stuff like that.
You know, when we think about that, there are a lot of different management practices across the state, depending on rainfall and what type of cropping growers are doing. Also, livestock. There's certainly big areas of South Dakota where livestock is just huge. What kind of impact do you see on the soils with grazing stocks and those types of things?
You know, it all depends on really field conditions and how well you manage your grazing and ground conditions at the time. Those that do well, they're paying attention to precipitation, moisture content in the soil. If it's wet, you obviously don't want to be there. You know, just like you don't want to drive in a wet field, well, you don't want to put your livestock in a wet field. So the guys that are really paying attention to their soil conditions do much better when they're grazing their stocks or their grass or whatever it may be.
We're talking with Nathan Jones, a state soil scientist in the state of South Dakota. And Nathan, I guess when it comes down to nutrients, what do you see as big needs in South Dakota where we're having some struggles or where you're getting a lot of questions?
You know, nitrogen comes up a lot, and I think just paying attention to your nitrogen levels in the soil, not just throwing nitrogen at a crop because, you know, of a recommendation from your local agronomist or the local college in the state. You know, go out there, get your soil samples, know what you have in the soil. That way you put on what the soil needs or what the plant needs and, you know, no excess. We do see some issues with, you know, some water bodies that are polluted because we've got excess nutrients being washed off. And if we're paying attention to our soil nutrient levels, then we're going to be able to reduce that.
Yeah, it was interesting doing soil sampling this fall, and you hit it right on the head with nitrogen, Nathan, that we saw some nitrogen soil levels we didn't expect, depending on where we're at and what kind of rainfall we had, what kind of crops we were able to raise this year. Nathan Jones, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on the show today, and good luck here finishing out the rest of December.
You bet. Have a great day. Thank you.
And we got holidays coming up really quick again. It seems like, man, we just got through Thanksgiving, but already a lot of talk about the end of the year. One of the topics will be iron. We'll continue that discussion right after this.
Fill once, plant all day. The Thrive 3D application system from FMC is a revolutionary in-furrow crop protection platform that plants up to 480 acres between refills. The Thrive 3D application system mounts to most major planter brands and can be yours at no cost with the FMC Freedom Pass program. To learn more, call 815-362-7747 today. Always read and follow all label directions.
When it comes to competitive herbicide formulations, you know Nufarm. They've been bringing growers trusted brands like Weedmaster, Patriot, and Diablo for decades, made right here in the USA. What's your favorite Nufarm brand? Email it to turnuptheburn@nufarm.com and you'll be entered to win a monthly $1,000 product giveaway. In these unprecedented times, you're facing unprecedented pressure. Nufarm's here to help.
Get tough on herbicide-resistant weeds. Add Tough 5-EC into your post-emergence tank mix and increase control of some of the toughest-to-kill herbicide-resistant weeds that plague corn, such as Palmer amaranth and water hemp. Tough 5-EC is a selective contact herbicide with an underutilized mode of action that provides faster kill and application flexibility for post-emergence control of key broadleaf weeds. Ask your local retailer about Tough 5-EC or visit BelchamUSA.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Did you know soybean diseases like white mold and sudden death syndrome can survive in your soil even after rotating crops? Prevention of these diseases is a constant battle, and yield loss from an infection can be devastating. The right management plan makes all the difference. Keep your beans safe next spring with Heads Up Seed Treatment. Heads Up guards your seed treatment from both white mold and SDS. Stay protected and profitable by asking to have your seed pre-treated with Heads Up. Learn more at headsupst.com.
You would never plant seed or apply herbicide with a 20% success rate. So why are you still applying phosphorus fertilizer with a maximum availability of only 20%? Double your phosphate availability and increase yields with NutriCharge from AgroTech USA. NutriCharge's patent-pending technology protects phosphorus from negative chemical reactions that tie up your fertilizer investment. NutriCharge performs across all soil types and pHs, Contact AgroTech USA or your local Van Deese supply representative today.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy. All the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Welcome back to Ag PhD Radio. Brian Hefty here along with my brother Darren. We've been talking iron throughout the show today, and no, not equipment, but the nutrient iron. Just a couple things I'll leave you with when it comes to iron and any discussion about iron. This nutrient is far more available when the pH is low, and it's almost a straight line down. Well, I mean, not quite that bad, but I mean, the availability of iron goes down quite a bit as pH goes up. So the lower the pH, the more availability. The higher the pH, the less availability. So in other words, you could have the exact same amount of iron in the soil at an 8 pH versus a 5 pH. And at the 5 pH, your plants will have plenty of iron, most likely. I mean, assuming this was a decent amount that you had in the soil. And at an 8, your plants might be starved for iron. Now, one of the big issues we see when it comes to just iron in general is with soybeans, and we'll have what they call iron deficiency chlorosis, where there is not a shortage of iron in the soil necessarily, but there is a shortage of the right form in the plant. And what happens is the good, or how we would term it in very simple language, the good iron, the ferrous iron, turns to ferric iron. And even if you do plant tissue analysis, you got yellow beans out there, you do plant tissue analysis and you go, well, I don't understand what's going on. The plant tissue test says I have enough iron. Well, you do, but the plant has it in the wrong form. You need it in the ferrous form, not the ferric form. So that's what ends up happening in those high pH spots. And sure, in the short term, you can put something out there like soy green. But in the long term, what we really want you to do is try to fix that pH. Figure out what's going wrong. Why is it bad? And I mean, most likely it's a drainage issue, but it could be excess magnesium, sodium, calcium. You might need to put a bunch of sulfur out there to try to flush the excesses out. You've got to make sure the drainage is fixed first. And we get a lot of questions about elemental sulfur lowering pH. Yes, it can, but the first thing has to be drainage. If you don't fix the drainage, elemental sulfur will not work for you at all. If you have soil that, let's say the pH is fine, but you're just short on iron, how can you fertilize with it? Well, like on our farm, we've been lucky because we've gotten water treatment lime that has all kinds of iron. Because just think about water treatment. What are they doing? What are they pulling out of there? Hard water ions. Iron's a big one. So there's a lot of iron quite often in water that gets pulled out. So if you get water treatment lime, that's a very inexpensive and very available source of iron for you. Otherwise, you could certainly buy iron sulfate to broadcast over your fields. Or you could use some iron chelates. There are a lot of people who will use iron chelates, and we use a little iron all the time, just even in our good pH fields where we don't have IDC issues or anything like that. We'll use that in our starter. We'll do a little bit foliar. Iron can help that plant green up a little bit more. And so if you want that nice dark green color, iron a lot of times is one of the keys. So we would encourage you, soil test for iron. Take a look at your tissue analysis. If you've got issues out there, I mean, just like everything else, you got to get them fixed. Oh, and I guess there's one last thing I'll leave you with. This is something we picked up from Neil Kinsey years ago, where he just said, hey, guys, when you're looking at soil tests, make sure you always have more iron than manganese. Otherwise, it just seems like you have issues with availability. So make sure your iron levels are always higher than your manganese levels. And generally speaking, then, you're in pretty good shape. All right, let's get back to the Ag PhD mailbag.
All right, Brian, I want to shift gears here and talk a little sulfur. I got two questions here about sulfur. One, since you just mentioned Neil Kinsey, Tanner sent this in, and he said, in Neil Kinsey's Hands-on Agronomy book, page 95. Now, I'm just going to say the reason that I brought that up, a lot of our listeners have bought Neil Kinsey's Hands on Agronomy book. We get a lot of comments over the year about something out of the Hands on Agronomy book. So if you don't have one, I would suggest getting one, Hands on Agronomy by Neil Kinsey. Anyway, Tanner says on page 95, Neil says, an excess of any of the four major cations makes that major element the weakest link in the chain, and adding sulfur will result in a reduction of that cation.
That's what we're just talking about.
And how does sulfur reduce the most overabundant cation? And then that kind of ties in with Mark's question.
Well, wait, let me just answer that question. So I was just saying excess magnesium, sodium, or calcium. Okay, well, if you put any of those together with sulfate, then they become leachable. So now you've created a salt. Instead of just having an element out there, now you have a salt. So magnesium sulfate, for example, that's Epsom salts. Okay, if you have good drainage, like we said, drainage is always first. Make sure your drainage is taken care of. Then you can start flushing some of those excesses out with sulfur, and that would be how you do it. The sulfate is, and he is asking, how does this happen? Well, just think about it. If your soil is predominantly filled with magnesium, just as my example here, well, of course, sulfate's just, it's sitting there. It's going to start combining with stuff. Well, the most available thing and the most abundant thing is magnesium. So then that's where you create the Epsom salts. That's a salt. That's leachable. So with normal moisture and good drainage, that will flush out of your soil. Okay, continue.
All right, then Mark followed up with a question here, and Mark's from Maryland. He said, just wondering why sulfur is not on Mulder's chart. I really got interested in Mulder's chart a couple years ago, and you guys were talking about it, but notice sulfur is not on there.
I don't know.
Well, sulfur interacts with about every nutrient. And
yep, it does.
You see, most nutrients that we're applying to the field, it's copper sulfate. It's zinc sulfate. So there's sulfur with a lot of these things.
A fertilizer, yes. Okay, what Mulder's chart is, if you're not familiar with this, you may have seen something when you were in college, for example, or at one of our workshops, where it's a circle, and then around that circle are all the different nutrients, calcium, potassium, iron, magnesium, boron, and so on. And then there are arrows pointing to each other. And in some cases, they are red arrows and antagonistic, and in other cases, they're green arrows and synergistic. So just as an example, potash and manganese are synergistic. So there are arrows pointing both ways, meaning that if you have more potassium, then usually you have a little more manganese that's available. If you have more manganese, then there's a little more potassium available. On the other hand, you've got nutrients like, let's say it's phosphate and zinc, or phosphorus and zinc. Why do we talk about that ratio all the time? Because those are antagonistic. And what happens is if you get the ratio out of whack, and just as an example, like on our farm, we said, we're short on zinc. Well, let's put a bunch out. And if you listen to me on a regular basis, if a little is good, well, more's got to be better. We had that, plus we had spreader breakdown, and so we got way too much on one field. But anyway, the point is, when we got that ratio out of whack and we were down to like 3-1 phosphorus to zinc, our yields went way down. When we got that ratio back up to 10-1, hey, now we're in good shape. But if we go all the way to, let's call it 40-1, well, now we're back again where we have a yield issue, because if there's too much zinc, we create an issue with phosphorus. Too much phosphorus, create an issue with zinc. So why isn't sulfur in this? I have to assume it's just because either Mulder didn't study the impacts of sulfur on every nutrient, or he or she, I don't even know who Mulder is, but from years ago, apparently, I haven't really studied it that closely, or I guess I probably did, but that was a long time ago, so I don't remember from my college days because I'm getting old now. But anyway, I'll just say the other factor is maybe sulfur doesn't have a positive or negative impact on these nutrients. In other words, more sulfur or less sulfur doesn't impact them. But I, for one, don't believe that, because I do know for a fact that if you've got good sulfur levels in the soil, you will have better nitrogen availability in the plant. I don't know why sulfur is not on there. And who knows, maybe sulfur helps everything. I just am not really sure. I don't have the answer to that question.
Yeah, it is interesting, though, looking at soil tests and seeing where high levels of sulfur are and what the impact is on other nutrients. And this has certainly been one. I know if you've been to the Ag PhD field day. Now, last year, we didn't have a field day with the whole pandemic thing going on. But the last couple of years leading up to this, we've seen some different trials where we put some high rates of different types of sulfur out there, trying to change pH, trying to improve nutrient availability, those kinds of things. It definitely has an impact.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, the sulfur isn't improving the nutrient availability. The pH was, I agree with that, and the pH got caused by the sulfur. So however you want to look at that, Darren might say, oh, it definitely ties together. I say, well, roundabout it maybe could. But either way, we want you to have good sulfur levels in your soil, and usually you have a little bit better yields. All right, we will continue answering your questions in the Ag PhD mailbag right after this.
I'll take predictability where I can get it.
With their CropWise Seed Selector, NK Seeds combines local knowledge and local data to show me where their seed fits.
And even where it doesn't. Because out here, predictability is hard to come by. And success matters. Find your seed at nkseeds.com.
We now bring you an important news bulletin.
This just in from Live Action News.
Innovation has come to the world of burndown.
New Elevore herbicide controls your toughest weeds, even glyphosate and ALS-resistant weeds like mare's tail and henbit. Talk with your retailer about Elevore herbicide today and ask how you can start elevating your burn down.
You deserve to have a building that will last for generations. With more than 110 years of experience and thousands of satisfied customers, Morton Buildings is the industry leader you can trust. Unlike other construction companies, you work with Morton Buildings craftsmen from conception to completion. There's no better time to buy. Lock in your new building for 2020 today. Contact your local Morton sales office or visit mortonbuildings.com.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Bellum is Rotam North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Bellum. For more information, visit bellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Give your corn a strong defense against stress throughout the season with MycoApply Endoprime SC. MycoApply Endoprime SC uses four specially selected species of mycorrhizal fungi to protect your crop against stress. That means more access to water and key micronutrients while building a healthy soil structure for stronger crops for years to come. Stronger corn starts beneath the surface. Learn more about MycoApply Endoprime SC at endoprimecorn.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Back, you're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Right in the middle of the Ag PhD mailbag time here, you can send us a question, radio@agphd.com is our email, or you can give us a call, 844-44-AG-PHD.
Now, I got to say, we were during the break, and Darren goes, so, should we cover these questions that really need an answer soon, or do you want to get into a couple of negative emails? And I said, negative. Let's have
go,
some fun.
Let's go negative. All right. Well, this one comes from Matt. And we were talking about, we did a television program segment about if you're taking out CRP ground.
Yep.
Now, Brian, if you're taking out CRP ground, is it possible that you'd like to keep it in CRP but couldn't get re-enrolled?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That happens all the time.
Just so Matt understands this, it's not necessarily, oh, no, we've got ground that's not productive that's coming out. There could be ground that is totally productive that got put in CRP for one reason or another.
Absolutely. So just as an example, we had a landlord who we ended up buying some of his ground. He had some ground in CRP just because he didn't want to farm it years ago. Well, we took it out and we're raising, 230 bushel corn and 75 bushel soybeans there. It's tremendously productive. But anyway, go ahead.
All right. So Matt says, yeah, don't plow or cultivate, but spray the living heck out of that field. That alone will damage the soil because of the runoff and chemical left in the soil when the residue of those plants breaks down.
Wait, why is there runoff? Okay,
exactly.
So, right, that's my point.
Runoff from the chemical.
Right, yeah. So, number one, most of the time there is no runoff. And number two, most of the time, if we're just going to burn something down out there and it's CRP, we're spraying Roundup. Well, Roundup's done when it hits the soil, so that's not going to hurt anything in the soil. Here's the thing. It's unfortunate, but there's just all kinds of misinformation out there. So whether you want to call it fake news or, as I would term it, just flat-out misinformation, people are feeding you with the words that, oh, this is bad, whatever it happens to be. You know, in this case, chemicals. Well, no. In a lot of cases, they are not bad. Let's think about the good. Okay, I can save organic matter by not doing tillage. Well, if I'm not going to do tillage, I got to do something for the weeds. How can I control the weeds then? I can spray. It's amazing. So now, because of and thanks to the herbicide, we can do much better for the organic matter in the soil. Now, people want to talk about all these like carbon dioxide, for example, the greenhouse gases. Okay, I mean, farmers are the answer, and it's sad that our governments and a lot of people in the media don't have any idea what they're even talking about with global warming and stuff. If you want to reduce greenhouse gases, you have incentives for farmers to raise more yield, because more yield means you're going to absorb more carbon dioxide. That's the number one greenhouse gas. So, and when we can store that down in the soil in organic matter, we win. So that's what you want, is the use of herbicide. Anyway, and a lot of these herbicides are super safe. So I'm not saying we don't want to use precautions and everything else, but, you know, people rail on glyphosate. That's absolutely proven to not be a cancer causer. Don't listen to all this nonsense that's out there. I mean, there's all kinds of research out there showing it's not a cancer causer, and it works on an enzyme found only in plants. We don't even have that enzyme as human beings. So anyway, go ahead.
All right, this one comes from Noah, and we were talking about how weeds hurt crop yields.
Yes.
Noah says, weeds are competing for the nutrients in your soil due to the lack of a healthy ecosystem within the soil. Might I suggest looking up regenerative agriculture? Anyway, I can see you guys are trying to help, but this information is outdated. Keep up the attitude of wanting to help people, but I suggest you also try to help the planet.
We are. I mean, we were just talking about that in the last question. The number one thing that will help the planet, if you want to reduce greenhouse gases, if that's what you mean, and having more organic matter, so less nutrients get to the groundwater and all that kind of stuff. I mean, the number one thing is we got to have more yield. We have more yield. We have fewer greenhouse gases. That's a flat out proven fact. Okay, so regenerative ag, that's exactly what we're doing, is regenerative. So we're raising higher yields and continuing to have higher yields. We can actually build soils now. It's amazing what we're doing. So we have much cleaner water, everything than we used to. I mean, farmers are doing a fantastic job with that. But, you know, I wish that was true, that, oh, hey, if we just balance everything out, we won't have any weeds. It just flat out doesn't work that way. Now, don't get me wrong. We try that. We talk about that all the time, that, hey, we want to do everything possible to raise a great crop, and the great crop will choke out a lot of your weeds. But it just isn't a perfect system, and we don't have a way without using herbicides to, or hand weed, you can hand weed if you want to keep those fields clean until we get crop canopy. I mean, we're trying, and we're getting closer all the time, but weeds are tough, and as soon as you figure out a way to not have weeds, guess what? Some other weeds show up. It's hard. It's really hard, and both Darren and I have been working on it our whole lives.
All right. Next one comes from Diego in Argentina. He said, in our country, we don't have soybean traits for dicamba, liberty, and 2,4-D's, and we're struggling to fight some broadleaf weeds, namely pigweeds, post-emerge.
Yep.
I was curious about fumesifen and what you could tell me, because we see mixed results. Sometimes it works great. Sometimes it doesn't work well. Wondering what we could do to improve our chances.
Yeah. So, number one, I do think it works very well, but here's the problem with pigweed. It can grow really fast, and it can put on a crazy amount of seeds. We were just talking on with the last question about, you know, weed issues and stuff. Well, one seed, one pigweed plant can create over a million seeds. One pigweed plant, million seeds. Okay, so just imagine if 100 go to seed. All of a sudden, you got 100 million seeds out in your field that you got to fight. Okay, it's not easy. Fumesifen is okay on a lot of the pigweed species if they're small. With like water hemp, for example, that'll grow 2-3 inches in a day with good heat. So it's a real problem, because where do I want you to spray it? When it's 2 to 4 inches tall. So you got to be right there. The key, if you don't have Liberty 2,4-D dicamba, the key is you got to use good pre-emerge herbicides. Our suggestion is always to use a yellow, something like trifluralin or prowl. So that'd be trifluralin or pendimethalin. Plus, use a little metribuzin. Plus, use one of the PPOs like Authority or Valor. Flumioxazin is Valor, by the way. Sulfentrazone is Authority. But get three effective modes of action out there pre. Then you don't have so many weeds coming early post. But you want to hit it early post with that fumesifen. And I throw a group 15 with it along. So like metolachlor, for example. And there are several different ones. But I just say, if you can get five products out there, four different modes of action, and you got all that done before the weeds are 2 to 4 inches tall, you're in really good shape. Now you're ahead of the thing. After that, we usually talk about Cobra. And off the top of my head, I don't remember the active ingredient with Cobra. But yeah, Flexstar early, Cobra later. They're both PPOs. They both are going to burn the beans. I don't love either one of them, but if you don't have the other options and your pigweed is glyphosate resistant, that's about what you're left with.
All right. Thanks, Diego. Really appreciate the questions today, and good luck to you. This one comes from Wayne. I'm thinking of doing some soil sampling. I'm going to do some grid sampling myself. Wanted to do 2.5-acre grids with a full analysis. Any suggestions on programs to set up grid points that where I could write my own prescriptions? Also, do you have a preferred lab, and what should I expect my cost per acre?
Okay, so we have an app, the AgPhD Soils app, and you can just go to agphdsoils.com for more information on that. We set this app up, and so just so you know, we make $0 on this. We literally did it to try to help farmers. And we had worked with another company years ago setting something up. We did it this time with together in conjunction with Farmers Edge. 5-acre grids cost like $4.80 an acre to do. So if you sent a sample in to Midwest Labs, that's where stuff runs through, just on your own, it would cost you more than that for a sample to get run when you do the math. So what I'm saying is you get a volume discount on your sampling because it's going through us. And anyway, you can create your own prescriptions. You can do stuff yourself. So it's really pretty simple and easy. And so that would be our suggestion. But we're happy that you're doing soil testing. It's tremendously important. I mean, we used to do very little soil testing. And now I'm going, why did we ever do that? Because we spend so much money in fertilizer. I just want to spend it right, or at least close to right. And if I have information, good soil test information, then I feel like I'm doing a lot better with my dollars.
All right. Thanks a lot, Wayne. Really appreciate that. Good luck to you here as you get started on that program on your farm. Thanks for listening to our show today. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.